Iran lodges an official protest over the U.S. seizure of its oil tanker near Greece, saying that it is deeply concerned about Washington's violations. Russia and China veto a U.S. push at the U.N. Security Council to toughen sanctions against North Korea. And U.S. police account for a recent deadly shooting in a school in the state of Texas is under scrutiny. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. Iran has summoned the charge d'affaires of Switzerland that represents the U.S. interests in Tehran to protest the seizure of an Iranian flagship in Greek waters. The Iranian Foreign Ministry expressed strong protests at the U.S.'s clear violation of international regulations on free navigation. The ministry urged the immediate lifting of the confiscation of the ship and its cargo. On Wednesday, it also summoned the Greek charge d'affaires in Tehran to protest the confiscation of the vessel. Greece impounded the Russian-operated vessel this week following a U.S. request. Iran says the ship was carrying oil and sought refuge along Greece's coast after experiencing technical problems and bad weather conditions. Iran says the U.S. has loaded the cargo, and that amounts to international piracy. Historian and political analyst Marcus Papadopoulos says Washington uses Greece as a tool to deepen its influence in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea.
Greece is used as a tool by Washington to not only enhance America's position in the Eastern Mediterranean and also in North Africa, but also to try and interfere in Russian foreign policy objectives in the Eastern Mediterranean, Syrian foreign policy objectives in the Eastern Mediterranean, and also Iranian foreign policy objectives in the Eastern Mediterranean. And it comes as no surprise to me whatsoever that the Greek government, which is only independent in theory, has acted on the instructions of Washington by detaining this Iranian vessel. Why? It is a way of the Americans attempting to interfere with Iranian trade as a way of trying to weaken the Iranian economy. Greece, as I said, is fundamental to America's position in the Eastern Mediterranean.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says some countries in the region and beyond are sending Takfiri terrorists to Afghanistan. Ali Shamkhani said terrorism and radicalism are among the main causes of insecurity in Afghanistan. He pointed the finger at the United States, saying Washington and its expansionist policies are at fault for the 20-year war in Afghanistan. Shamkhani said the U.S. must release Afghanistan's frozen funds and make up for the financial damage that it has inflicted on the country. The top Iranian security official was speaking in Tajikistan's capital, Dushanbe, at a regional summit on Afghanistan. Shamkhani said his country has always backed the security and stability of its neighbor. He said Iran is hosting around 5 million Afghans without effective international aid. The Iraqi parliament has unanimously approved legislation that criminalizes any forms of normalizing ties with Israel. The legislative body said the law represents a true reflection of the Iraqi people's will. It urged Arab Islamic parliaments to follow suit. The bill requires all Iraqi officials, including those in the semi-autonomous Kurdistan region, as well as the institutions and media, to refrain from establishing relations with Israel. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has hailed the move as a historic decision to counter the trend of normalization by some Arab countries The United Arab Emirates, Sudan, Bahrain, and Morocco established diplomatic ties with Israel in 2020 under U.S. brokered deals. Palestinians see the normalization as a stab in the back. Political commentator Saeed Shahabi has hailed the Iraqi parliament for criminalizing normalization of ties with Israel. He says the move is a milestone in Arab diplomacy.
Of course, this is a milestone in Arab diplomacy, in Arab parliamentarian experience. It shows that there is the will of the people, which is against any normalization with the occupation, because normalization means approval of the occupation of Palestine. This is something that is a taboo in the minds of Muslims, Arabs, freedom fighters, everywhere. So in Iraq, we have the marji'iyah, the religious leadership, that would definitely not accept any normalization, any approval of the occupation of Palestine. This is why we see the Islamic leadership in Iran, in Lebanon, in Yemen, in Iraq, all against such a move. So the Iraqi parliament's criminalization of normalization of relations with the occupiers of Palestine is a very important development, and we hope that other parliaments will be courageous enough to take such a step.
The United States on Thursday drafted a resolution at the UN Security Council calling for more sanctions against North Korea over its missile program. The U.S. push, however, failed after China and Russia vetoed the resolution. Both countries argued that further punitive measures will not resolve the tensions. We discuss the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen. Hello and welcome to the news review. In this edition, the United States has failed to push a tougher UN sanctions system on North Korea after Russia and China vetoed the vote on measures.
We have often stated that the introduction of new sanctions against the DPRK is a path to a dead end. We have stressed the ineffectiveness and the inhumanity of further strengthening the sanctions pressure on Pyongyang starting in 2006, since many restrictive resolutions were adopted against Pyongyang.
The situation on the peninsula has developed to what it is today, thanks primarily to the flip-flop of U.S. policies and failure to uphold the results of previous dialogues.
The Chinese envoy added that sanctions will have humanitarian consequences for North Korea. The U.S. drafted the resolution called for a cut in oil imports by North Korea over its recent firing of an intercontinental ballistic missile. Pyongyang has already faced several rounds of U.N. sanctions over its missile and nuclear program over the past years. North Korea says its program is aimed at self-defense in the face of regional threats led by the U.S. North Korea also says that the U.S. has failed to fulfill its promise to lift sanctions after their leaders held summits in 2018 and 2019 to resolve the dispute. To discuss that further, we're joined by Kinjuo Shu, a senior fellow at the Pangol Institute and political analyst live from Beijing. We also have with us Andrew Leong, independent China specialist, who's joining us live from Hong Kong. Let's begin with our guest from Beijing, Mr. Shu. If you could please tell us more about this sanctions policy that the U.S. is pursuing and, of course, implying it against any country that it deems to be an enemy and wants to restrict its actions. But these sanctions are basically hurting ordinary people, aren't they?
Well, that's true. Every time, you know, when there were sanctions being mapped out, it's said, you know, it would say it's targeting this country. That's a very abstract term. It's the people who will suffer the consequence over the sanctions. Remember the U.S. sanctions, there are two types of sanctions. You know, one is from the U.N. over the past 15, 16 years. Basically, China, Russia, U.S., they cooperate with each other. They did impose some sanctions on North Korea for its nuclear development. But at the same time, the U.S. has its unilateral sanctions on North Korea. But I think, you know, for China and Russia, in particular China, for the recent years has been asking the U.S. said, basically said, that you should reduce some of the sanctions, lift some of the sanctions, and then to encourage North Korea to start, change its policy and start negotiation with the U.S. side.
Okay, so before we continue this discussion, let's take a look at some social media reactions to the story. Okay, so here we have Yassini, who says the United Nations belongs to everyone, not to the private property of the United States. Thomas Liu says the Koreans have been invaded by the Japanese for hundreds of years. Time they stood up and make their own. It is quite time that they make their own decisions, not by the Japanese or the U.S. Ricardo Alfredo says the UN could sanction the U.S. because they are the main troublemakers in the world. Mutzka says China and Russia did the right thing. U.S. wants wars on other countries so they can benefit from them. U.S. built its wealth and power through World War I and World War II and a whole bunch of other wars it instigated. And also Matthias Mornfolu says North Korea has no dealings with the U.S. and its allies. All their unilateral sanctions have no effect. And Mr. Leung, this is the final question I'm asking you. We have less than 2 minutes left, so if you could please wrap this up quickly. We also had another comment about the U.S. benefiting from wars, World War I, World War II, and many other wars, and that military-industrial complex in action. Tell us more about that and why the U.S. basically has shown and proven in action that it is not genuinely pursuing peace on the Korean Peninsula.
Well, in fact, what the United States worry about is not so much security that the North Korea would invade the United States. The concern is more the threat to its hegemony, that we're seeing that its hegemony power in Asia Pacific is now being challenged by China, and even North Korea is defying its dominance. So that's the worry. It's not worry about the North Korea would likely invade the United States. And of course, that the military industrial complex is also is playing a role in the sense that the complex wants to create war so that they can make more money. And of course, that the war in Ukraine is benefiting the American military hugely with all these weapons and supplying Ukraine and other countries. But I think that at the end of the day, the United States is seeing the next 10 years as the most crucial part in maintaining its hegemony, because China is rising rapidly, both economically and militarily. And then even in the South China Sea, China is now able to defy American dominance in many ways. And even in Europe, the European countries, even though they are rallying behind the United States to contain Russia, but the leading countries like Germany and France would like to adopt a more nuanced and independent policy. So the United States is really quite desperate to maintain its hegemony. And then the situation in North Korea is only one of the points on this chessboard, which is now shifting quite rapidly.
Well, thank you very much. Andrew Leung, independent China specialist out of Hong Kong, and Mr. Kindo Xu, senior fellow at the Pangol Institute and a political analyst, joining us live from Beijing. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts and views with us. And thanks to all of you for following this edition of the News Review. China has hit back at a Thursday speech by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken that called for action to counterbalance Beijing's influence. China has accused Blinken of smearing its domestic and foreign policies. China says Blinken's speech spreads false information and interferes in its internal affairs. Beijing says the speech shows that Washington seeks to suppress China's development and maintain its own hegemony and power. The top American diplomat accused China of posing the most serious long-term challenge to the international order. Blinken said China wants to reshape the order and called on countries to prevent that. Ties between the two powers have become tense in the past 2 years, with both pointing the finger at each other's policies. And U.S. police are under scrutiny now for their late response to a school shooting that killed 19 elementary students and 2 adults in the state of Texas on Tuesday. A video circulating online shows families of the students are urging officers to take action while standing outside the school. Local media say police waited outside for at least 40 minutes before confronting the gunman. The shooting took place in the state of Texas. Earlier, authorities held a press briefing praising police for their quick response to the massacre. Families of the victims dismiss that. Meanwhile, activists have gathered outside the U.S. Capitol calling for action to control gun violence.
I'm here because I'm scared it's going to be me next. I don't know who's next. Me, my friends, my peers, and nothing's being changed. I'm a 17-year-old girl in high school, and something needs to be changed, and there needs to be laws in place.
I'm a grandma. I'm against guns. That's all. Gag. It makes me gag every time this happens, and it happens all the time.
Always.
2 times in the last 12 days.
It's our second go-round.
How much more can we put up with this stuff?
Activists called for more restrictions on people legally acquiring guns. Some also proposed prohibiting gun purchases by the people under 21. They argue that such rule could have prevented the 18-year-old shooter in Texas from acquiring weapons. The U.S. has seen several mass shootings this month. Almost 2 weeks ago, a gunman opened fire at a grocery store in Buffalo, New York. 10 people were killed and 3 others wounded. 11 of the victims were African Americans. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. Among the believers are men who have been true to their covenant with God. Of them, some have completed their vow, and some still wait, but they have never changed in the least. the commander of the faithful quotes the Holy Quran, chapter 33, verse 23. Hamza, Ja'far, Ubaidah are the three people who embody this part of the verse. Of them, some have completed their vow. Well, these personalities are very important. The commander of the faithful mentioned them in such glowing terms. Such personalities should be highlighted, commemorated, and praised. Such narrations show the significance of Hazrat Hamza. From the first moment he was martyred, the Holy Prophet decided to portray him as a role model. The Holy Prophet described him as the master of martyrs. When he entered Medina after the Battle of Badr, he saw that the women of Medina were crying for the martyred.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Four of the martyrs were from among the immigrants, and 68 from among the immigrants, and 68 were from among the Ansar. The women whose Ansar dear ones had been martyred were crying and moaning. The Holy Prophet listened for a while and said, "There is no one to cry for Hamza." When this news reached the ears of Medina women, they said that they would cry for Hamza before they would cry for their own dear ones. In other words, the Holy Prophet encouraged the whole Medina to cry for him. This is an act of creating a role model. That did not only concern the people living at that time. Rather, it concerns the whole history and all Muslims. The work that you two are doing is not only related to Iran either. What you are doing, if you do it well, hopefully, will be a service to all Islamic and Arab countries and also countries speaking other languages. All these countries must and will benefit from your work, and perhaps the artist will step forward to carry out big artistic feats. Now, what we should do is to determine the elements constituting the personality of Hamza. A great task is to clarify the qualities that gave him such greatness. In my opinion, this is one of the tasks. These qualities should turn into a model for us and for others so that we can learn from them.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Midstream.
The results of the Lebanese parliamentary elections reflect changes in the country's political map.
Three indicators are being monitored a week after the final count of these results. The first relates to the international position amid confusion about whether Lebanon is waiting for a new initiative led by France or whether it will be left alone in the face of the economic crisis accompanying a political debate that is expected to expand in light of a Saudi intervention that pushes some hot-headed people to continue the political battle against Hezbollah. The second indicator is related to the constitutional entitlement related to the election of the Speaker of Parliament amid a wave of pressure aimed at boycotting the vote for Speaker Nabih Birri and isolating the most prominent and possibly only Shia candidate by electing him with votes that are much less than half the number of deputies. The third indicator is a determined attempt by groups speaking in the name of change to enter into a populist revelry based on the idea that the logic that accompanied the October 17 uprisings in Beirut should continue within the parliament, while spreading an exaggerated atmosphere to prevent any opposing discussion between the elected representatives. The elections for the parliament speaker became the main talked about event in the past week, after parliamentary blocs and representatives of the opposition forces announced their refusal to vote for Nabih Birri, which makes the session a merit that will not pass as smoothly as in past years, especially since the votes that Birri is likely to receive will be the lowest since 1992. It is feared that this new crisis will reflect paralysis in parliament, similar to what was happening in the government formation and the race for presidency. The problem lies in the origin of the session, which needs a quorum of 65, as the election in the first session requires an absolute majority and a relative majority in the second and third session and beyond. Well-informed sources feared that the representatives of October 17, also known as NGO MPs, and the political blocs that refused to elect Birri would boycott the session, which would prevent a quorum, leading the country towards parliamentary paralysis. Simple math guaranteed votes close to 50 from Hezbollah and its allies, and from 9 deputies from the Progressive Socialist Party, also known as Walid Jumlat's bloc, which is likely to give all its votes to Birri, while attention remains on the position of the Free Patriotic Movement, also known as Jobran Basil's bloc, which has not yet been decided. Serious effort has begun, in which Hezbollah is leading, to reach a formula with the Free Patriotic Movement to secure an electoral outcome for Nabih Birri, provided that the movement's share in this settlement would be the position of Deputy Parliament Speaker. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Tension still prevails in the political discourse of winners and losers in the aftermath of the Lebanese parliamentary elections. It is not likely that the duels between all parties will stop in the intervening days of the first session of this new parliament, which will witness the elections of the parliament speaker according to an unresolved conception, unlike what was the case in all previous sessions since 1992. This does not mean that the speaker, Nabih Birri, will not be the candidate for the position, but the position of the elected representatives do not indicate an easy majority, as per the usual, which opens the door early for discussion about the nature of the political fronts that will arise in the post-election stage. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Al-Khansa, journalist at Al-Akhbar newspaper. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Hamza. Now, forming a national unity government has always been the concern of Hezbollah, whether before the elections or afterwards. Between the rejection of the opposition forces and their blackmail of the Free Patriotic Movement, it may be too early to predict the fate of this government, whether it will fail or not, before the winners, the newcomers to the parliament are positioned. They choose their position and their options are pretty well determined. How do you assess the results of the May 15 parliamentary elections in Lebanon in the sense of parliament majority?
The stance of Hezbollah and the resistance bloc inside the parliament, whether in 2018 elections or this latest one, has always been one that calls for a unity government in Lebanon. This stance has always been steady, whatever the election results were, whether in favor of the resistance or not. In the 2018 elections, the resistance bloc had the majority in parliament, and they still called for a unity government. However, the opposing parties had the exact same position they have today, which is a complete refusal to take part in a unity government. Today, after the final results of the 2022 elections were announced, we see that the parliamentary blocs have been divided into several diversified blocs. Despite this diversification, Hezbollah, Amal, the Free Patriotic Movement, and their allies still outnumber the opposing deputies. I cannot say they have a majority in all internal issues to be voted about in parliament, but there is a new terminology in Lebanon that explains the situation. There will be political agreement as per each case being discussed alone in parliament, case by case. Most probably, this will be the process that will be visible in the Lebanese parliament. Yet, we should keep in mind that the new deputies who emerged to power, who called themselves the independent bloc, added to the Samir Jaja's Lebanese forces, they both raised the same anti-resistance slogans that directly targets the Lebanese resistance, its existence, and its weapons. This team will most probably keep on pushing this political confrontation. The statements issued by these groups since the elections results were out indicate that they refuse to collaborate with any resistance forces to solve the crisis in Lebanon or to meet national merits, on top of which is the elections for the position of parliament speaker.
Well, Mr. Hamza, the parliamentary elections have indeed ended, but the Lebanese and Lebanon has actually entered into a new crisis, maybe open to unknown directions this time. As you just mentioned, that we don't have a majority. It might be by peace, as you just said, but the first of these is not the elections of the speaker of the parliament, nor later on the government, and later after that the presidential race. But beginning with the position of speaker right now, how do you think the cards will be played out, since Nabih Berri might have the least amount of votes since 1992?
Concerning the candidacy of Nabih Berri for the position of parliament speaker, it's nearly confirmed that he will get the necessary votes to win the position. However, the question this time is about the process in which he will gain those votes. As you mentioned, the opposing parties are counting on providing the least number of votes for Nabih Berri, an attempt to serve a blow to the resistance camp in Lebanon. They also want to send a direct message concerning the deputy parliament speaker position by securing a higher percentage of votes to the deputy position than that of speaker position. The deputy is traditionally held by a member of parliament from the Orthodox sect. These are the tactics being discussed today. Jaja's Lebanese forces have their own candidate for the deputy speaker position, so that the Free Patriotic Movement, also the new independent bloc, are yet to get together and choose a candidate. There's a complete package being currently discussed when it comes to parliament speaker elections and his deputy. The high-pitched statements we hear from different political blocs in Lebanon indicate a process of negotiations happening in the country concerning the party which will secure the big deal when it comes to the position of deputy speaker, a deal which constitutes giving Maronite votes to Speaker Berri in return to secure Shia votes from the resistance bloc toward the deputy speaker position.
Well, but it seems that something interesting happened just after the election results were announced, where the head of Hezbollah loyalty to the resistance bloc, Haj Muhammad Ra'ad, who is a member of parliament, again now said about the formation of a national government and the need for the other party to accept it as not to lead Lebanon into the abyss. And his reference to the civil war came to prove that what has been previously proposed since the renewal of Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's insistence on a unity government. The opposing parties are openly refusing this. Are we at a violent crossroads for Lebanon? Is this why he mentioned the civil war?
Before we get to the point of predicting a stage of violence in Lebanon, let us be clear that everyone in Lebanon agrees that there are new deputies who have recently arrived to the parliament, who hold new approaches unprecedented in the history of the Lebanese parliament. This new scene was expressed during the electoral campaigns of these new deputies. They hold blatant unseen before positions, concerning their readiness to build ties and normalize with the Zionist entity. On the contrary, this same new bloc has a big problem with a main Lebanese political component, that is namely the entire Shia sect and the resistance bloc in Lebanon. They simply want to isolate this sect and remove the armament of its resistance. This is a new political current in Lebanon that has openly announced its alliance with the Zionist Israeli entity. This is the specific party whom MP Muhammad Raad was referring to when he mentioned possible clashes with what he called the puppets of the Zionist regime. MP Muhammad Raad said that Hezbollah is ready to cooperate with all sorts of opposers, except those who are agents of the Zionist entity in Lebanon. This is a very clear and powerful message from Hezbollah. However, we must keep in mind that the U.S.-sponsored project, which these new MPs are part of, will be part of the ruling process in the Lebanese parliament for the next 4 years. I mean specifically the roles of the U.S. embassy and the Saudi embassy in Beirut, along with whatever projects they represent that does not end with normalizing trends with the Zionist entity. Rather, passes through the millions of dollars they spend to secure the arrival of such deputies to the Lebanese parliament by paying a lot of bribes and excluding the Sunni leader Saad al-Hariri from the political scene to ensure the arrival of Zionist puppets to the parliament under the banner of Jaja's Lebanese forces and a small group of puppets who refer to themselves as the independent bloc. Yes, they did arrive through elections, but Saudis had higher chances in mind than what actually happened. Today, all the anti-resistance groups in Lebanon and the region should sit tight and look closely at the election results. The results do not support the ruling of the pro-Zionist blocs. This means they have to accept to share power with those who outnumbered them, or else the alternative to this is a full-blown confrontation.
Well, it is very interesting to see how the political scene is being shifted in Lebanon with foreign intervention, especially Saudi and U.S. Foreign intervention. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Al-Khansa, journalist at Al-Akhbar newspaper, for joining us to talk about these very interesting results. Now, please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Erdogan's bargaining with NATO in return for a safe zone in Syria.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In the rams between it and the West over the accession of Finland and Sweden to the NATO alliance, Turkey found that the most appropriate opportunity to bargain with the West and extract concessions from them on another issue involving the safe zone project that it intends to establish in northeastern Syria. Now, Turkey aims to export Syrian refugees residing on its land to resettle in this so-called safe zone. Meanwhile, Kurdish forces have launched a wide media and diplomatic campaign to oppose the Turkish project and prevent its implementation, describing it as a threat to the country in Syria and to the Kurdish presence as a whole. Erdogan's safe zone slash NATO bargain in this following report.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called on the NATO members to support his country's efforts to establish a safe zone on the border with Syria to accommodate refugees and ensure the security of the southern border in return for his country's accession of Finland and Sweden to the NATO alliance. As soon as Ankara announced its intention to resettle about 1 million Syrian refugees and transfer them from the Turkish interior to the areas it occupies in northern Syria, the Syrian Kurds mobilized against it, considering the project an attempt to change the demographic composition of the city to Afrin and, quote, Arabize it, unquote. The Turkish discourse so far confirms that the project to build alternative residential cities and villages for refugees does not target Afrin alone, but will include also areas in Jarablus, Al-Bab, Idlib, Ras Al-Ain, and Tal al-Abyad. The announcement of the opening of a housing complex with 100 homes in Afrin gave indications about Turkey's undeclared intentions to focus the resettlement plan in this region, where the Kurds constitute the majority of the original population. Erdogan's plan seems like a clear and direct announcement of a deal that Ankara is preparing to ensure field and political gains in exchange for accepting the expansion of NATO and the inclusion of the two countries bordering Russia within NATO. The deal Erdogan is looking for, which he outlined during a meeting with the ruling Justice and Development Party AKP deputies, cannot be considered surprising. It corresponds to Erdogan's continuous efforts to complete the illegal project he launched along the Syrian border more than 3 years ago, with the aim of forming a strip under Turkish control that distances the Kurds from its borders and ensure Turkey's continued control of that region. It is a project that Erdogan has been aiming for since the beginning of the global war on Syria in 2011, when it requested the establishment of a safe zone near its borders, which it was unable to achieve due to many variables, including the Russian position and the Turkish-European and Turkish-American differences, especially after the Kurdish separatists' alliance with Washington in northern Syria and the U.S. military intervention in east of the Euphrates, where the United States occupies Syrian oil regions in the northeast of the country. It seems that the Turkish president, who is facing increasing political pressures against the backdrop of the electoral conflict in his country, in which the issue of Syrian refugees is one of its main axes, is trying during this period to invest all available resources to advance his project, which aims to resettle about 1.5 million refugees out of about 3.5 million by re-exporting them to Syria and resettling them in residential communities along the border strip, which means a process of resettlement and Turkification at the same time.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Mrs. Tahseen Al-Halabi, who's a writer, researcher, and political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Halabi. Mr. Tahseen, now, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called on NATO members to support his country's effort to establish what he called a safe zone on the border with Syria to accommodate Syrian refugees for his country's approval of Finland and Sweden to the NATO alliance. Does he even have the approval of his own parliament before he seeks that of the NATO for a safe zone inside of Syria?
Without any doubt, Erdogan did not receive the approval of his parliament for such a move. I believe a lot of Turkish deputies will oppose such a bargain with NATO. However, it would not be a surprise if Erdogan takes that decision all by himself without going back to the parliament. If so, he will be fully responsible for the consequences of such a decision. On the other hand, building some sort of an entity for refugees on Syrian territory, then by all means, he has no right whatsoever to intervene within 1 inch of Syrian soil. This exploitation and abuse towards the Syrian refugees should be dealt with accordingly by the United Nations. His bargains and proposals with Finland and Sweden should never be accepted at the backdrop of this blatant violation of human rights, international law, and violation of Syrian sovereignty.
Mr. Tahseen, Ankara also announced that it will not agree to the inclusion of Sweden or Finland in NATO, claiming that the two countries harbor terrorists from the Kurdish Workers' Party, the PKK, while it is demanding the extradition of 12 people from Finland and 21 people from Sweden, in addition to canceling the two countries' decision to ban arms exports to Turkey against the background of its illegal incursion in Syrian territory. Will NATO approve of such a bargain with Erdogan?
I don't believe so, because these states have historic ties with the Kurds in Iraq and the Kurds of Syria. Then the U.S. came along and became included within these ties as well, by using the Kurds in Syria against their own country and nation. Such important issues would not allow Finland and Sweden and the NATO to end their relations with the Kurds, whether in Iraq or Syria. The U.S. now controls the fate of the Kurds known as SDF in northeastern Syria. Along with the U.S. is the U.K. and France and Italy and the rest of European countries. They want to keep using the Kurdish issues to pursue their goal of fragmenting Syria and to offend its independence and sovereignty.
Mr. Halabi, Erdogan is trying to invest all available resources that he has and positions to provide a boost to his project, the Safe Zone inside of Syrian territory, which aims to resettle about 1.5 million Syrian refugees by exporting them to Syria and settling them in residential communities in northern Syria with financial support from many parties, namely from Qatar, which includes Turkish schools, Turkish institutions, and hospitals, which means a process of settlement and Turkification. At the same time, do you think this Turkification process will be applicable, knowing that the Syrian government is yet to finalize the northern part of the country militarily?
I believe that all what Erdogan wants to achieve by exploiting the Syrian refugees will not be applicable. Why? First of all, because Syria, with all its resources, will resist and reject such a project with all available means. Turkey is not an external party that had no role in the war on Syria, the invasion and the violation of Syrian sovereignty. Therefore, Erdogan does not even deserve to play the role of the savior of Syrian refugees by attempting to resettle them inside Syrian territories. On the contrary, Erdogan is attempting to seize further land in northern Syria. Erdogan has expansionist goals inside Syria. He seeks to keep on pushing to achieve such goals. I believe that Erdogan will have to confront the Turkish people themselves, who openly oppose such expansionist policies, which exploits helpless refugees for the sake of balkanizing Syrian land. Also, Syria and its allies won't accept such a move by Turkey. Neither will Russia, which sponsors the Astana talks and always reassures the importance of Syria's sovereignty and independence, and not be exploited by any foreign power. Russia considers that any presence of Turkish forces on Syrian land is an illegal presence. Syria will never accept the continuous presence of Turkish forces or U.S. forces on its soil. I believe Erdogan might plan to exploit the refugees, but even the refugees will not accept those kind of control from Erdogan. Why should they, when they can simply return as free citizens to their land? After Syrian President Bashar al-Assad issued a presidential amnesty decree towards 80% of all criminal or terrorist acts by any Syrian national. This amnesty allows for all Syrian refugees to return to their homeland free from anyone's control. Erdogan wants to bypass every Syrian attempt to bring back its citizens safe and sound to Syria, to rebuild their country and live in peace with all their fellow Syrian citizens.
We'll have to wait and see how this plan of Erdogan will play out and how Russia will have to respond as well as the Syrian government to this illegal approach by Recep Tayyip Erdogan. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Tahsin Al-Halabi, writer, researcher, and political commentator, for joining us from Damascus to talk about the recent plan by Recep Tayyip Erdogan to bargain for NATO to expand its membership by getting more land, more illegal occupation inside of Syria. Thank you very much for your contribution, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for the latest from West Asia on the Mideast Stream.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am your humble host, Zainab. Today in our studio, we have with us Islamic researcher, Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome to our program. So today in this session, we would want to address to some more Sunni narrations. Are there any more Sunni scholars who reject the claim that, which is mentioned in some of the Sunni narrations, that Imam Mahdi, ajallahu ta'ala faraja, his name is like my name and his father's name is also like my father's name?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So first of all, we said that the claim that the Shia, they have distorted the narration and they have omitted the part which says Ismu Abihi Kasmi Abi, his father's name is like my father's name. This claim is rejected because many Sunni scholars, they have quoted the same version without this phrase. Secondly, we proved that even according to Sunni criteria, these narrations which have this part are weak.
True.
And according to some Sunni scholars, some of them are mawdu'a, which means they are forged, they are fake narrations. The question now is that whether any of Sunni scholars, they have also mentioned that this group of narrations
are fake
or not. And interestingly, the answer is positive because we have, for example, the great Sunni scholar of Hadith, Kanji al-Shafi'i in Al-Bayan fi Akhbar Sahib al-Zaman, which is specifically about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. He refers to 31 narrations about this question, whether the name of the father of Imam Mahdi is like the name of the father of the Prophet or not.
All right.
And then he says that there is no doubt, I mean, a person who is a man of knowledge, he has no doubt that this addition has no value. I mean, it's not authentic. It's been added. Hadha ziyada. This has been added to the narration, and it's not a part of the narration. This is in Al-Bayan fi Akhbar Sahib al-Zaman, page 483. Now, interestingly, one of the Wahhabi scholars, whose name is Rabi' bin Muhammad al-Saudi, he has a book for rejecting the claims of the Shia, and the title of the book is Al-Shi'atu al-Imamiyatu al-Ithna Asharia fi Mizan al-Islam. Then he quotes the narration in which we have this addition, that his father's name is my father's name. And then he says, وَلَا رَيْبَ أَنَّ هَذَا قَدْ وَدَعَهُ أَصْحَابُ مُحَمَّدْ بِنْ عَبْدُ اللَّهِ النَّفْسُ الزَّكِيَّةِ. There is no doubt about the fact that this part was forged, was added by the companions of Muhammad bin Abdullah, who is famous as Al-Nafs al-Zakiyah. Now I will talk about this part later in today's program. So this Wahhabi scholar also mentions that this is a forged narration. One of the great scholars and lecturers of Al-Azhar, Jama' al-Azhar in Egypt, Saad Muhammad Hassan, also says that ahadith ismu abiki ismu abi ahadith mawdu'a. All the narrations which have added this part, his father's name is like my father's name, are forced. So we have a couple of Sunni scholars, Wahhabi scholars, who have the same viewpoint that these narrations are forged. Yeah.
Dr. Karimi, we'll answer that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old morning.
I would like to talk about some possibilities why this phrase has been added to this narration.
Exactly. Like, this is the point that has been revolving in our heads since a long time.
The point is that it is clear that in the history of Islam, different people, they have claimed to be the promised Mahdi because the Mahdi was introduced by the Prophet and many Muslims were waiting for him. And unfortunately, in different times and era up until today, different people, false claimants, they have claimed to be the promised Mahdi, both among Shi'as and Sunnis. So they knew that the Prophet has mentioned that his name is Muhammad. So specifically those people whose names was Muhammad, I mean, maybe they had more interest in claiming that we are the promised Mahdi. And in some cases, their father's name was Abdullah.
All right.
So they thought that if they add this part to the narration, that the name of the father of Imam Mahdi is Abdullah, then there is more possibility for people
to
accept this claim from these people. Now, at least we have two people in this regard. One of them is the same person who was mentioned by that Wahhabi scholar. He's Muhammad bin Abdullah bin al-Hassan, who is also known as An-Nafs al-Zakiyya. Now, according to that Wahhabi scholar, some of the followers of Muhammad bin Abdullah An-Nafs al-Zakiyya, they claim they added this part to the narration to prove that this is the promised Mahdi. Of course, as Shia, we may not agree with him. I mean, we do not find this claim, because An-Nafs al-Zakiyya is also mentioned in Shi'i sources. At least he himself has not talked about that narration and to have added that part to the narration. Because this Wahhabi scholar claims that Banu al-Hasan, the offspring of Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, when they wanted to preach An-Nafs al-Zakiyya, they added this part to the narration so that people would be interested in supporting him. But more important than him is the famous Abbasid caliph, who it's weird that he is famous as Mahdi the Abbasid. I mean, Mahdi al-Abbasi. Nowadays, in most of the books of history, he is famous as Mahdi the Abbasid.
All right.
But the point is that his name was Muhammad, and his father's name was Abdullah. So he's Muhammad bin Abdullah. He himself and his followers, it is a possibility that they have added that part to the narration to claim that I am the promised Mahdi. And that is why somehow he changed his name. He introduced a new epithet for him and he called himself Mahdi. So first of all, his name is Muhammad. His father's name is Abdullah. He adds that addition to that narration, this is a possibility. So far he has two criteria to be the promised Mahdi. And now he himself calls himself as Mahdi. So much so that today people know him as Mahdi the Abbasid, not Muhammad the Abbasid. Ibn Taymiyyah, he himself says the following about him. He says that because of the fact that the narration which reads the name of Mahdi is like my name and his father's name is like my father's name was famous among the people, some people made some false claims to the extent that Mansur, the Abbasid caliph, named his son as Muhammad and gave him the laqab, the epithet of Mahdi, so that his name is Muhammad, his father's name is Abdullah, and he is called Mahdi. This has been mentioned by Ibn Taymiyyah.
Okay, now he himself says that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Ibn Kathir al-Dimashri also says that he that Mahdi al-Abbasi, he became famous as Mahdi, رَجَاءَ أَن يَكُونَ الْمَوْعُودَ بِكِ فِي الْأَحَادِيثِ. He was hopeful of being that promised Mahdi, which is mentioned in the narrations. So the point is that at least there is a possibility that in the history of Islam, there have been some people whose names was Muhammad
and the father's names Abdullah. Were Abdullah.
So they added this part to the narration so that people come to this wrong conclusion that this is the promised Mahdi.
Mahdi.
The next point about the